All right, Erev Tov. It's good to be back after a hiatus of a few weeks. I think the next couple weeks at least, 3-4 weeks, we'll do it consecutively. And we move tonight into the 20th century, to the Presidents and the Jews, Part 13, looking at the presidencies of Theodore Roosevelt and William Howard Taft, sponsored as always by Becky Navi Katz, Ili Nishmas Yonah ben Arya Leib, Roosevelt being the 25th, and Taft the 26th presidents. So Theodore Roosevelt became the youngest president ever, 42 years old, still the record, when he succeeded William McKinley after McKinley's assassination. Roosevelt had an astonishingly diverse resume. He was prone to great pronouncements and pithy expressions, and he was our first flamboyant president. He knew how to play to the public, play to the media. There was no log cabin and no youthful struggles for Roosevelt. He was the first president to be called by initials, TR. No one called Lincoln AL. And he grew up amid wealth and privilege, and so he felt an obligation to the public that dovetailed nicely with his ambition. So Roosevelt was a larger-than-life figure. I should mention, I remember reading years ago that he pronounced his name Roosevelt. And it was Franklin's side of the family, they were fifth cousins, who pronounced it Roosevelt, but everyone's used to hearing Roosevelt anyway. So Roosevelt was blustery, was aggressive, but he had a keen sense of justice, of right and wrong, that was not at all subject to dissuasion. He was the first president to actively campaign for office. He was the first vice president to succeed a president because of death, who then was re-elected in his own right. Remember, Tyler, Johnson, and Arthur had not been re-elected. And since Roosevelt, every vice president who succeeded to the presidency because of death has been elected. That's Roosevelt, Coolidge, Truman, and Lyndon Baines Johnson. Roosevelt was the first president to travel extensively around the country, the first to travel abroad while president, the first to fly in an airplane, and the first president to hold regular news conferences. He brought reporters into his confidence, and then he used them to get his message out, closed them out when he wanted to, when he didn't like what they were writing, but even set up for them, first time ever, a permanent place in the White House. So building on McKinley, but expanding McKinley's goals greatly, Theodore Roosevelt was the first president to willfully make the presidency the focal point of government, which was a dramatic shift in the power structure of American political life from which we've never recovered. In retrospect, it's strange that no one ever thought in these terms before, but Roosevelt reasoned that each congressman represents just a specific constituency, but only the president represents the whole nation, and that's how he saw himself, and that's how he conducted his presidency, and so he could be arrogant and domineering. After all, he was the only person elected by everybody. It was TR's presidency that was defined as the bully pulpit, the phrase that he used, and he was headstrong as well, reflecting to excess what was once called manly virtues. Can't even use such an expression anymore. It offends too many people. And his White House became a center of national focus, not only because of him, but also because he had young children running around the White House getting into trouble. He was the first president since Lincoln who had children in the White House. All right, so Roosevelt was born 1858 in New York City. He's the only president born in New York City. He lived in a brownstone. He grew up in a brownstone on East 20th Street, growing up in luxury. Maids, servants. His father was an heir to a fortune made in real estate and plate glass manufacture, which became very popular mid-19th century. His mother was from the South, and as it turned out, a closet supporter of the Confederacy. His maternal uncle was a Confederate agent. For a number of reasons, including the obvious, he paid someone to take his place. Roosevelt's father, Theodore Roosevelt Sr., did not fight in the Civil War. And Jr. tried and tried again to compensate for that. He found it humiliating. whatever the reason, and there are other reasons as well, his father could not see himself fighting his wife's family, Theodore the son developed an aggressive, warlike streak that he never lost. When his sons went off to war, World War I, he said, "I hope and pray they'll all come back, but before God, I'd rather none came back than one able to go had stayed at home." That's a strong statement. Indeed, one son was killed in action in World War I, and two sons died in World War II, although one was a suicide. As is very well known, Theodore Roosevelt was sickly as a child. He suffered from asthma, had very poor vision to boot, which necessitated wearing glasses, and that too inspired him. He was intellectually curious, very bookish. Theodore Roosevelt wrote dozens of books in his lifetime, from beginning around the age of 20, books on a variety of topics, a biography of Oliver Cromwell, a naval history of the War of 1812, as well as a number of books about his own life, the Rough Riders, and an extensive, long autobiography. But at age, he also wrote more than 150,000 letters in his life. So he has quite a paper trail. But at age 12, his father told him, "You have the mind, but you have not the body. And without the help of the body, the mind cannot go as far as it should. You must make your body." And Roosevelt became extremely active and robust, hiking, hunting, boxing, other masculine pursuits, if I could use such a phrase today. You visit the Theodore Roosevelt estate, Sagamore Hill on Oyster Bay, Long Island. You have to be careful not to injure yourself walking around this house because of all the stuffed animal heads that hang from the walls. He was quite a hunter. Moose, lions, tigers, bear, etc. I was in his dining room looking at these animal heads staring from the wall. You wonder how anyone can have an appetite eating a meal in that room. It's a taxidermist's paradise. In the early 1870s, the Roosevelt family took a trip across the world, a luxury of the wealthy, and they traveled through the land of Israel, among other places. They went to Hebron, went to Beit Lechem, saw the sights, and Roosevelt kept a diary. And after visiting Yerushalayim, a 15-year-old Theodore Roosevelt recorded in his diary. He wrote, "In the afternoon, we went to the wailing place of the Jews. Many of the women were in earnest, but most of the men were evidently shamming." All right? He was quite perceptive even at that age. It could be, may find the same thing if he went today. Note also that Roosevelt grew up in New York City around Jews and was quite familiar with them. Roosevelt graduated from Harvard and married a local Bostonian girl named Alice Lee. They had one child, Alice, who became the last surviving child of Theodore Roosevelt, dying at age 96 in 1980. So many of us here will remember her being in the news in the 60s and 70s. She was always in the news. Now, Alice's mother, also named Alice, died of illness just 2 days after giving birth to her, and just hours after Roosevelt's mother had died in the exact same house. Two bereavements on the same day, leaving him with an infant, two-day-old daughter. Grieving, Roosevelt left Alice in the care of his sister, and he escaped west to the Dakotas, where he became a rancher. And for the first time, as an adult, he ventured out of his cocoon, and he developed a reputation for toughness and for brawling. In a bar in the Dakotas, a drunk holding two pistols called him Four Eyes, which he hated, by the way. Because of his glasses, Roosevelt knocked him out with one blow. By the way, it's interesting that Roosevelt hated the name Teddy. Hated it. And he would tell anyone who called him that, but nonetheless it caught on with the public. Upon his return from the West, he married his second wife, Edith. They got married in England. And they had 5 children together. Not so surprisingly, Edith and little Alice, child from the first marriage, never got along. Alice, 17 years old when her father became president, was the first presidential child to act out, to make waves. She was a party girl. She smoked in public. ostentatious, loud, brash, in other words, just like her father. And she once commented that her father always had to be the center of attention. It's quite a statement. She said of Theodore Roosevelt, he wants to be the bride at every wedding and the corpse at every funeral. She was the exact same way. Unlike her father, though, she was openly licentious after she married. That she married a congressman, they had one child, but that she did her own way. It wasn't his. Roosevelt's father told him before he went to Harvard, and note the order, he said, take care of your morals first, then your health, and finally your studies. And that's good mussar even today. Roosevelt became a New York State Assemblyman in the early 1880s. He ran for and lost an election for mayor of New York in 1888, but he was appointed by President Harrison, for whom he had campaigned, to the United States Civil Service Commission. There, he became a fierce opponent of the spoil system, and he instituted competitive examinations for thousands of positions, and he parlayed his prominence into an appointment as New York City Police Commissioner in 1894. During his tenure, as Roosevelt himself told the story, a Jew-hating preacher from Germany, a rector, Alvart, came from Berlin to preach a crusade against the Jews in New York. Many New York Jews pleaded with the police commissioner Roosevelt not to allow it or not to give him police protection. So Roosevelt told them it was impossible, nor did he want to make the guy into a martyr, but he said he would do the next best thing. He made the preacher look ridiculous by assigning for his protection a Jewish police sergeant and more than 25 Jewish police officers. And they accompanied from place to place, and Roosevelt said it was the most effective possible answer. And then he added, I quote, it was an object lesson to our people, whose greatest need it is to learn that there must be no division by class hatred, whether this hatred be that of creed against creed, nationality against nationality, section against section, or men of one social or industrial condition against men of another social and industrial condition. We must ever judge each individual on his own conduct and merits, and not on his membership in any class, whether that class be based on theological, social, or industrial considerations. The truth is, in the upper echelon in which the Roosevelts moved, in that strata of society, this was not a very common sentiment. The opposite. But nonetheless, he adhered to it his entire life. In 1896, he campaigned hard for William McKinley, and he was rewarded with a job, Assistant Secretary of the Navy. Why not Secretary of the Navy? Well, McKinley was concerned about Roosevelt's reputation for hyperactivity. So theirs was an uneasy relationship. McKinley on Roosevelt, I'm afraid he's too pugnacious. Roosevelt on McKinley, he has no more backbone than a chocolate eclair. Now the latter was said in the context of the provocations that led to the Spanish-American War in 1898. Roosevelt pushed and prodded for the war. If he would be the only soldier, what the battle would suffice for him. He refused to absolve the Spanish for responsibility for the sinking of the Maine, despite contemporaneous evidence that they were uninvolved. So it was Roosevelt who pushed for the war. It was Roosevelt, in his capacity as Assistant Secretary of the Navy, who notified Commodore Dewey out in the Pacific to prepare for an attack on the Philippines should a war come. When war was declared, Roosevelt, against the advice of many in Washington, resigned his position, enlisted in the army, was commissioned a lieutenant colonel, and gleefully led troops into battle in Cuba. And not just troops. Roosevelt brought along with him a cadre of journalists who would tell his story and chronicle his heroism. The truth is that the importance of his charge up San Juan Hill was somewhat overrated, but the truth is also that Roosevelt was fearless in battle, riding his horse, making himself an easy target, but inspiring his men, the Rough Riders, to great success. To Roosevelt, it was all very glamorous. To his political career, it was a catalyst. Only two people emerged from the war with national reputations, Theodore Roosevelt and Admiral Dewey. Roosevelt, in fact, was nominated for the Congressional Medal of Honor, which he campaigned for in his lifetime. Think about last time, it's the exact opposite of McKinley, who ordered that he not even be nominated for what he did during the Civil War. Jealous army officials blocked it, but Roosevelt was actually awarded the Congressional Medal of Honor for his heroics in the Spanish-American War in 2001 by President Clinton, one of these trivial presidential acts that distract people from bad times, just a slight delay of a century. Just a year after the war, Roosevelt was elected governor of New York, and we noted last time, Jews voted for Roosevelt in droves. Jews had served with him in Cuba, and Jews recognized that because of Theodore Roosevelt, they had been given the opportunity to avenge all the crimes committed by Spain against the Jewish people. So I quote in part, to read a little more this time, when he ran for governor, a Yiddish flyer was circulated on the Lower East Side that read in part, think of this in Yiddish, it's in English though, under TR's command, under Theodore Roosevelt's command, there were many Jewish Rough Riders. Roosevelt was like a brother to them. He recommended them to the president for promotions and sang their praises to the world. Every vote for the colonel of the Rough Riders is approval of William McKinley and the war. Every vote for Theodore Roosevelt's opponent is a vote for Spain. Can any Jew afford to vote against Theodore Roosevelt and thereby express his disapproval of the war against Spain? Vote for Theodore Roosevelt. Vote to express your approval of Spain's defeat. Truth be told, Roosevelt didn't even win the Lower East Side, and he lost New York City by 60,000 votes, but he won because he had a large margin in the rest of the state. But he was very popular, and he had a national reputation that made him the obvious choice to be McKinley's running mate in 1900. McKinley was afraid to make Roosevelt the Secretary of War, which was the post that he really wanted, so McKinley thought there was less harm in making him vice president. And together, in the election of 1900, they won handily. In a speech in early September, Theodore Roosevelt said, one of his most famous statements, "Speak softly and carry a big stick, and you will go far." September 2001. He said that. Less than 2 weeks later, Theodore Roosevelt was sworn in as president in Buffalo, where he had gone to be with William McKinley after the latter was shot. The place is now a National Historic Site in a museum. I visited also a couple of years ago. It's a nice building. Roosevelt stayed there for a few days. They have a museum about McKinley and Roosevelt, the administration, and of course the assassination as well. The year in which they lived is very interesting. And again, if you're in that area, you should certainly stop by. Well, how did Theodore Roosevelt make the presidency his own? He was appropriately deferential when McKinley was killed. Only his daughter Alice broke protocol, saying that she greeted the news of McKinley's death with, I quote, sheer rapture. It's not the type of thing you want to say. But Roosevelt also vowed to maintain McKinley's policies. In the beginning, he kept all of McKinley's cabinet, and they continued those policies, at least for a time. Two of them, these are very distinguished people, two of them, Elihu Root, the Secretary of War, and Charles Dawes, who's controlled the currency, but later became was a close advisor to McKinley and the vice president under Coolidge, both of them would win Nobel Peace Prizes. Few presidents enjoyed the presidency as much as did Theodore Roosevelt. He built a tennis court on the White House lawn and could play up to 100 games a day. He loved to box. He brought amateur boxers to the White House to box him. That ended when one blinded him in the left eye. His boys were rambunctious, running around, breaking things. He regularly had to discipline them. He told the boys' teachers to use straps and whips to discipline them. Once they and their friends put spitballs on some of the White House portraits. Kids are kids. But Roosevelt was always around people, talking nonstop, preaching, influencing policy, sometimes subtly, sometimes with a sledgehammer. He was full of energy. So he reined in corporate excesses. He began using the Sherman Antitrust Act to break up monopolies. He proposed and passed legislation protecting the rights of employees, regulating the meatpacking industry, child labor, etc. Almost every decision he made had a moral component to it, and he gained fame, as we know, as a trust buster. And it was Roosevelt who coined the phrase muckraker when a J.P. Morgan company was prosecuted for antitrust violations and outraged J. Pierpont Morgan. Himself came to the White House and complained to Roosevelt, saying, "If we have done anything wrong, send your man to my man and they can fix it up. Why prosecute?" It was a different time, but if you think about it, until Roosevelt's time, the hierarchy was the most powerful people in the country were the tycoons. Roosevelt changed that. Roosevelt would have nothing to do with Morgan, any special deals. He was a progressive hero. In fact, he would make today's limited government Republicans quite nervous. After his presidency, when Roosevelt went on safari in Africa to hunt big game, J.P. Morgan reportedly said, "America expects that every lion will do his duty." Meaning they hoping for the lions, not for Roosevelt. His domestic policies became known as the Square Deal. Every other deal, you know, Roosevelt's New Deal, Truman's Fair Deal, Obama's bad deal with Iran, they're all takeoffs on the original Square Deal. Roosevelt made an unprecedented mark in foreign policy. He suppressed the rebellion in the Philippines in 1902, strongly condemned the Kishinev pogrom in 1903, which almost 50 Jews were brutally murdered, hundreds injured, dozens of women raped. The Russian ambassador was called in, and the ambassador blamed the pogrom on Jewish creditors who had offended Russian peasants. This, of course, was false. The pogrom was arranged and sponsored by the local government. Roosevelt submitted a petition of protest, which the Tsar refused to accept, and his own letter as well. And Roosevelt later wrote, "I need not dwell upon a fact so patent as the widespread indignation with which the American people heard of the dreadful outrages upon the Jews in Kishinev. I've never in my experience in this country known of a more immediate or a deeper expression of sympathy for the victims and of horror over the appalling calamity that had occurred. It is natural that while the whole civilized world should express such a feeling, it should yet be most intense and most widespread in the United States. For of all the great powers, I think I may say that the United States is that country which from the beginning of its national career, most has been done in the way of acknowledging the debt due to the Jewish race and of endeavoring to do justice to those American citizens who are of Jewish ancestry and faith." Roosevelt took a leading role. It's interesting. The most esteemed Jewish leaders in America at that time, those reformed German Jews, were mostly silent in the wake of the Kishinev pogrom, not wanting to make waves. Roosevelt was also an unabashed imperialist, and he took that as a compliment. In 1905, he negotiated an end to the Russo-Japanese War, and for that he was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 1906. Only one other president has won the Nobel Peace Prize while in office. Best to leave it unmentioned. At least Roosevelt had accomplished something. Now, Roosevelt also fomented a rebellion in Panama against the ruling Colombians, because he had a vision of the Panama Canal. After the rebellion succeeded and the Panamanians were placed in power, he persuaded the Panamanians to build the canal in order to help U.S. trade. Keep in mind that in the first incarnation of the plan to build a canal in Panama, it was funded almost completely by the Seligman bankers, the Joseph Seligman Company. Not him, but his brother Jesse Seligman financed a French effort by de Lesseps, the fellow who built the Suez Canal, but it did not work. In 1906, Roosevelt appointed Oscar Straus, who was then the co-owner of Macy's, among other investments, as the first Jewish cabinet secretary, Secretary of Commerce, a department that Roosevelt himself had founded. That itself is a story. at a Jewish dinner honoring Strauss under the auspices of the venerable Jewish mogul, Jacob Schiff. Schiff was another German-born Jewish banker, philanthropist, died in 1920 with an estate that today would be valued at more than $600 million. So at the dinner, Roosevelt praised Strauss, and he said, "I did not name him because he was a Jew. I would despise myself if I considered the race or the religion of a man named for high political office. Merit and merit alone dictated his appointment." Jacob Schiff then spoke. Unfortunately, Schiff was completely deaf, did not hear a word that Roosevelt had said, and declared that, I quote, "Before making up his cabinet, President Roosevelt sent for me and informed me that he wished to appoint a Jew as a member of his cabinet and asked me to recommend the ablest Jew who would be most acceptable to my race. I recommended Oscar Strauss." It's not known who was more uncomfortable, Roosevelt or the audience, but he did say to Strauss, when he asked him to take the position, "I want to show Russia and some other countries what we think of Jews in this country." But of the reasons he gave Strauss why he wanted him, that was actually the last one. On the 250th anniversary of Jewish settlement in the United States, it was November 16th, 1905, Roosevelt wrote to Jacob Schiff, who was the chair of the official celebrations, a long and eloquent letter acknowledging the lamentable and terrible suffering to which so many of the Jewish people in other lands have been subjected, and underscoring what fine qualities of citizenship have been displayed by the men of the Jewish faith and race who, having come to this country, enjoy the benefits of free institutions and equal treatment before the law. And he acknowledged the great contributions of Jews to the founding and upbuilding of America, their service during the Revolutionary War, the Civil War, and he concluded, "I am glad to be able to say, in addressing you on this occasion, that while the Jews of the United States, who now number more than 1 million, by the way, it was at that time more than 3 million, but who's counting, while the Jews of the United States have remained loyal to their faith and their race traditions, they have become indissolubly incorporated in the great army of American citizenship, prepared to make all sacrifice for the country, either in war or in peace, and striving for the perpetuation of good government and for the maintenance of the principles and embodied in our Constitution. They're honorably distinguished by their industry, their obedience to law, and their devotion to the national welfare. They are engaged in generous rivalry with the fellow citizens of other denominations in advancing the interests of our common country. This is true not only of the descendants of the early settlers and those of American birth, but of a great and constantly increasing proportion of those who have come to our shores within the last 25 years as refugees reduced to the dire straits of penury and misery." He continued, "All Americans may well be proud of the extraordinary illustration of the wisdom and strength of our governmental system thus afforded. In a few years, men and women hitherto utterly unaccustomed to any of the privileges of citizenship have moved mightily upward toward the standard of loyal, self-respecting American citizenship, of that citizenship which not merely insists upon its rights, but also eagerly recognizes its duty to do its full share in the material, social, and moral advancement of the nation. With all good wishes, believe me, sincerely yours, Theodore Roosevelt." That was the letter he wrote in celebration of the 250th anniversary of the Jewish people in the Americas. In 1904, Rabbi Henry Pereira Mendez of Sherith Israel, is also in the president of the OU, asked Roosevelt to provide better for the religious needs of Jewish soldiers, and Roosevelt ordered that soldiers be permitted to attend Jewish services on the holidays. Now, there's another interesting Jewish connection to Roosevelt. In 1902, Roosevelt was called to adjudicate a border dispute between Mississippi and Louisiana. It's just hard to imagine today a president getting involved in such a thing. But Roosevelt wanted to have his hand in anything. So he went down there to the Mississippi-Louisiana border, and he took advantage of the opportunity of being there to hunt bear. He didn't kill any, to his great embarrassment. So one aide captured a bear, tied it to a tree for Roosevelt to kill. He refused, considering it unsportsmanlike. Of course, more sportsmanlike if you give the bear a rifle also, but that's a separate point. The fact that Roosevelt did not kill the bear became a major news story. In Brooklyn, Jewish couple, Rose and Jacob Michtam, owners of a candy store, decided to honor Roosevelt. Rose sewed a stuffed toy bear, put it in the window with the name Teddy's Bear. People then wanted to buy it. Michtam began manufacturing it, but not before he sent the original to Roosevelt and asked for permission. Roosevelt didn't think much would come of it, and he said, fine. Soon the Michtams closed their candy store, marketed the teddy bear, and they started the Ideal Toy Company. Roosevelt used the teddy bear as his symbol during the 1904 election, and the bear is now in the Smithsonian. In that election, Roosevelt won one of the greatest landslides in history. William Jennings Bryan took this election off, and the Democrats reached down their roster, nominated, also unthinkable today, nominated Alton Parker, the chief judge of the New York State Court of Appeals. He had never run for office before, never ran again, and it showed. Roosevelt won by 2.6 million votes, 56% to 37%, 336 to 140 in the Electoral College. When he ran in 1904, Roosevelt said he would not run again in 1908, a decision he would come to regret. So he personally handpicked William Howard Taft to succeed him. They would yet have a falling out. So Roosevelt, Taft won in 1908, we'll get to that in a moment, but Roosevelt ran again for president in 1912, after disagreeing with Taft on a number of issues, ran on a third-party ballot. He was shot by a would-be assassin in October 1912 before delivering a speech in Milwaukee, shot in the chest. Yeah, he insisted on delivering the speech anyway, saying that since he's not coughing up blood, he knows from having killed many animals in his lifetime that the shot is not fatal. And he said, ladies and gentlemen, I don't know whether you fully understand I've just been shot, but it takes more than that to kill a bull moose. And that became the name of his party, the Bull Moose Party. So Roosevelt was a bit of a wild man. After he left office, for the first time, 1908, 1909, he went on a hunting safari in Africa. Again, the media followed him, and there was a log kept. He killed 8 lions, 6 elephants, and a partridge in a pear tree, etc. After he lost in 1912, he traveled to the Amazon jungle, almost dying there of disease. Oh, he's left his wife home, by the way, with the kids, were all these endeavors, except on the safari, she did meet him in Europe afterwards. Roosevelt, like nothing, because of a third party, Wilson won in 1912. Roosevelt, like nothing about Woodrow Wilson, was a regular critic. When World War I broke out and America joined the war in 1917, Roosevelt demanded that he be given a regiment to go fight in France. He would, in his late 50s then. Wilson refused. He realized that Roosevelt had no idea that the nature of war had changed. Tanks and trenches had replaced cavalry charges up hills. So notwithstanding that Wilson might not have minded if Roosevelt met on a timely end, to send a horse against a tank would not be a fair fight. At the end of World War I, we'll discuss this more next week, the world is being carved up and many are looking for a place, a national home for the Jews. Roosevelt publicly supported the creation of a Jewish state, saying, I quote, peace could only be real when the Armenians and Arabs were given their independence, and it seems to me that it is entirely proper to start a Zionist state around Jerusalem, and the Jews be given control of Palestine. First time a president would say that, and in a political context, not just a religious context. To understand Roosevelt's end, we have to look at his successor, William Howard Taft, the 26th president. There are few people who have ascended to the presidency with the background, the talents, and the intellectual gifts of William Howard Taft. He always aspired not to the presidency, but to be a Supreme Court justice. In fact, he first rejected Roosevelt's entreaties that Taft succeed him as president. But ultimately, he was won over, even if his term was an unhappy one. Years after he left office, 1921, Taft was appointed by President Harding as the Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court. He's the only person ever to serve as the head of those two branches of government, the presidency, the executive branch, and the judicial branch. He's the only president, therefore, ever to swear in two other presidents, Coolidge and Hoover, in his capacity as Chief Justice. Taft was born in 1857 in Cincinnati to a very distinguished family. He visited his birthplace there as well. His father, Alfonso, was an unsuccessful politician, but he became a lawyer, a judge, and later Secretary of War and Attorney General in the Grant administration. He was a very demanding father who produced an extraordinary son, bright, talented, and a success in every position he held until he became president. Taft is best known for his heft. He was our biggest president ever, 6'2", but under the stresses of office, he ballooned. His weight ballooned to, at its most, about 355 pounds. And he became extremely stressed when things did not go well, and things did not go well for him in the White House. A new supersized bathtub had to be constructed in the White House when he once got stuck in the existing one. And he had a sense of humor about his weight. Taft, I got off the streetcar and gave my seat to three women. When, as Roosevelt's Secretary of War, Taft took up horse riding for exercise, Roosevelt sent word that Taft should stop, saying the riding was dangerous for him and cruelty for the horse. And indeed, one horse collapsed under the weight. It was a struggle. It's interesting, the modern biographers of Taft, you know, we're big in the cycle babble today, they relate his weight to a constant search for his parents' approval. His parents were very strict, and a low self-esteem. And that all affected him as president as well. But he could not control it until after he left office. We'll get to that in a little while. Taft grew up around Jews. Remember, Cincinnati, where he was born and raised, was the center of Reform Judaism. And the Unitarian Church, where the Tafts prayed, was right across the street from Isaac Meir Wise Temple, sadly named Congregation B'nai Yeshurun. The two houses of worship even had the first clergy pulpit exchange in American history. And Taft wrote that he was mightily impressed by Rabbi Wise's sermons, and the Wises and the Tafts even dined in each other's homes on occasion. So Taft never wanted to be president, but he was pushed by his wife Nellie, whom he married in 1886. She was very ambitious, prodded him. She came from a family that was so prominent in Ohio that her parents were personal friends with Lucy and Rutherford Hayes. In fact, as a teenager, Nellie spent several summer weeks in the White House on vacation when her parents went to visit the Hayeses. Nellie was well-educated, energetic, hated the limitations placed then on women. She's a liberated woman. She's the first lady to smoke cigarettes. But Taft saw her as the whip that would challenge him in life. Among their three children, also all high-powered, was the famed Ohio Senator Robert Taft, who became a serial presidential candidate in the 1940s, was known as Mr. Republican. Their daughter Helen earned a PhD and a law degree, which is quite rare over a century ago. Taft was always lauded, even by his detractors, for his honesty, integrity, and generosity. He was good-natured, warm, jovial, a hard worker, but he was ridiculed as a blundering president whose errors and inability to escape the shadow of his patron, Theodore Roosevelt, led to an ignominious defeat in 1912. And he took his failures as president personally. And one problem he had was his indecisiveness. And think back again, a lack of self-esteem. He struggled to make decisions because he knew he could not please everybody. So problems festered. He would just kick everything down the road. And part of his problem going in was he was not the dynamic, blustery, quotable media delight that Theodore Roosevelt was. And Taft was also too honest for his own good. He would share his private musings with the media about Congress, about congressmen, about the markets, etc., out loud, and not realizing that whatever president says, especially after TR, makes news and has great influence. And that forced him to watch every word. That made him even less popular. He did not handle criticism well, and he was very thin-skinned. All right, Taft graduated Yale in 1878, began his practice of law after graduating law school in Ohio. At 30, he became a judge, and he used connections to try to get President Harrison to appoint him to the U.S. Supreme Court. Instead, under Harrison, he became Solicitor General and then a federal judge. And as Solicitor General, he became acquainted and very friendly with Theodore Roosevelt, and their friendship blossomed. It was Taft who persuaded McKinley to make Roosevelt Assistant Secretary of War of the Navy in 1897. After the Spanish-American War, McKinley trusted Taft more than Roosevelt, appointed Taft the governor of the Philippines, and in every role he was always successful. In the Philippines, he basically built a free society from scratch, midwifing their political institutions, their financial infrastructure into existence, and all that despite contracting malaria. From there, he became Roosevelt's Secretary of War in 1904, and his hand-picked successor in 1908. Hand-picked, but he still had to be prodded by his wife. He still preferred to be a Supreme Court justice, and so he told Roosevelt, and Roosevelt said no, and at the time, you know, always have to balance out your desires against the reality that the sitting justices don't always die or retire on your timetable. But Roosevelt adhered to the promise he had hastily made in 1904 not to run for a second term in 1908, and he would come to regret that decision. Taft was nominated in an environment of tremendous popularity for his predecessor. If you think about it, it's different in many respects, but George H.W. Bush took office with that same popularity, adhering to his predecessor, but not necessarily to him. And that fact annoyed Nellie, who felt it was important that Taft be his own man and not be perceived as Roosevelt's third term. One cynic said Taft stood for take advice from Theodore. She hated that. Roosevelt was beloved, and that would grate on Taft, Nellie, and Roosevelt. So Taft handily defeated William Jennings Bryan, losing for the third and last time, 52-43%, doubling the Electoral College margin, 321 to 162. But the shadow of Roosevelt loomed large. Roosevelt was very paternalistic towards Taft, and their bitter divorce was probably inevitable. Taft did not take easily to the presidency, and he and many others continued to see Roosevelt as president. Taft would speak of Roosevelt, referring to him as the president. And Nellie would whack him in the head when he said that. She couldn't take it, and it was a habit he had to lose. And even though Roosevelt escaped to Africa on safari for over a year to allow Taft some breathing room, the media remained obsessed with everything Roosevelt did. He was that charismatic. Taft was hesitant and uncertain, and it showed. He was not a politician. He'd never run for public office before becoming president. And the two traits that undermined him, the loose tongue that he used to publicly ridicule opponents, and paradoxically his distaste for disagreement, dissent, even decision-making, Both did him in. He hated making people feel bad. He was rarely assertive, in contrast to Roosevelt, who was always assertive. He was unconcerned about his public image, and yet he was very sensitive to any personal slight, and he had the bad habit of falling asleep in public at dinners, even during conversations with people, which is also a product of obesity. He disliked the office of the presidency, and he lost himself playing golf almost daily. And related to that, he became the most traveled president ever, often spending months away from Washington, just traveling around the country. Never left the country, but traveling around the country. People began to notice. Nellie enjoyed the presidency much more than did her husband. She redecorated the White House. She ran it very formally, as opposed to the House of Bedlam it was under Theodore Roosevelt. She was the one who imported the cherry blossoms from Japan that still grace the Tidal Basin. And she began the practice of having entertainment in the White House after formal dinners. And she became the first lady to sit in on political discussions in the White House. And all this after having to take a year off from a stroke that felled her in the late spring of 1909, just a few months after they entered the White House. Taft was the first president ever to attend the Pesach Seder in Providence, Rhode Island, 1912, at the home of Colonel Harry Cutler. And he was the first ever to speak in a shul on a Shabbos morning, a temple, Reformed Temple, Rodef Shalom, in Pittsburgh, May 29th, 1909. You can see the pictures of the presidential motorcade driving up, and all everyone in the temple coming out to the street to greet him. Outside, in his speech, Taft mistakenly referred to the location as this beautiful church. Maybe it wasn't that far off. There he spoke of religious tolerance. Interestingly, it was Pittsburgh. The Pirates game that afternoon was delayed in order to allow Taft, who was to get there in time to throw out the first pitch. This at the behest of the Pirates owner, Barney Dreyfus, a Reformed Jew, member of Temple Rodef Shalom. And Taft later became the president who started the tradition of throwing out the first ball on opening day. June 12, 1912, Taft became the first president ever to meet with a delegation of rabbis led by the esteemed Rabbi Eliezer Silver, Zechar Tzadik Livracha, president of the Gudas Rabbanim. The rabbis had debated whether or not to keep their hats on, and Rav Silver insisted they do recite the bracha Shenasan Mikavod LeBasar V'Dam. Told what they were doing and why, Taft quickly put on his own hat as a sign of respect, and he also vetoed an immigration bill that would have limited Jewish immigration because it had a literacy test in English as a condition of immigration. But the truth is, this massive influx of Jews that began in 1880 really ended after the Taft administration, Wilson, the war, etc., and America became much more restrictive. Taft, in conjunction with a bevy of Jewish leaders that were his friends and supporters, men like Mayor Sulzberger, the ubiquitous Simon Wolf, and others, abrogated the Russian-American Commercial Treaty of 1832, it's 80 years later, to protest Russia's persecution of American Jews doing business in Russia and finding their travel restricted because they were Jews. We discussed this a few times already. It's not just that the Tsar persecuted Jews, Russian Jews. If an American Jew came, he was subject to the same restrictions on travel in the Pale Settlement, outside, etc. Taft publicly noted it was the first time in American history that a treaty had been voided because of a nation's religious persecution of its Jewish minority, which Taft found intolerable. In 1963, the Jews of Cincinnati dedicated the William Howard Taft Forest in Israel in commemoration of this act and Taft's friendship to Jews. Over time, Taft became, in the eyes of Republicans, insufficiently progressive. It's funny how words change their meaning in the world of politics over time. Today, nobody, associates Republicans with being progressive. He promised to lower tariffs, but when he signed the bill that accomplished little of that, he was maneuvered into signing it, his support began to weaken, and Taft further antagonized Roosevelt by reversing some of Roosevelt's conservationist measures. Taft was less inclined to declare land off limits for development. A scandal in the Forestry Service also soured the mood, and worse, in 1910, Republicans were shellacked in the midterm elections, losing their majority in Congress for the first time in decades, and to his eternal shame, and I mean that seriously, Taft supported the 16th Amendment. What's that? Created the personal income tax. Ugh. All of this led Theodore Roosevelt to seek the Republican nomination for president in 1912, an unprecedented act, and the rift with Taft was complete. Nellie would never forgive him. Roosevelt won 9 of 12 state primaries, but most states still had conventions, so Taft won renomination. Roosevelt started a third party, the Progressive Party, nicknamed the Bull Moose Party. I should note, after he was shot, Roosevelt, and he gave his speech, it's very manly, but he had to spend the next 6 weeks convalescing, so he was not able to campaign, so who knows what he gained from it. The Republican split enabled the Democrat candidate Woodrow Wilson to prevail, the only Democrat in a span of 36 years, only Democrat to be president in a span of 36 years. He won just 42% of the vote. Roosevelt came in second place, 27% of the vote, and Taft, the president, was humiliated, finishing in third place, the only time a sitting president came in third place in an election, humbled with just 23% of the vote, having won only 2 states and 8 electoral votes. So again, if you combine the Taft and Roosevelt votes, 27-23%, together, Republicans won 50% to Wilson's 42%, but that's not how elections are decided. In retirement, he was happy to leave the White House. Nellie was in tears. In retirement, Taft taught law at Yale. And again, he had a sense of humor. When he was told he was being offered a chair in law at Yale, he said, "A chair won't suffice. I need a sofa in law." And he kept up his public appearances as well. In 1917, he pleaded on behalf of the welfare of European Jewry. In 1919, he wrote a long article in National Geographic entitled "The Progressive World Struggle of the Jews for Civil Equality," in which he wrote with great understanding and empathy about the plight of world Jewry and their contributions to American life. And he argued that nations that gave Jews full civil rights would benefit as much as the United States had. In 1920, and for 2 years thereafter, Henry Ford's Dearborn Independent published weekly lurid details of the Jewish conspiracy to take over the world, how that would be true. And Ford used Zionism as its cover name, and the Protocols of the Elders of Zion as the basic text. Taft was among 100 prominent Christians to denounce these scurrilous articles as vicious propaganda, called on Ford to cease and desist, which Ford did not. Taft labeled this Jew hatred a noxious weed that was un-American. But Taft attracted notoriety. Keep in mind, his ambition was to be on the Supreme Court. One vacancy opened up in the mid-19-teens, and he became an enemy. A passionate enemy of Louis Brandeis. He loathed Brandeis for a number of reasons, especially because Brandeis was appointed by Wilson to the Supreme Court position in 1916 that Taft coveted. Now, the backstory was that Wilson was reluctant, we'll discuss it more next time, but Wilson was reluctant to appoint Brandeis as Attorney General because Wilson was looking for a representative Jew, and he was told Brandeis did not fit the bill. It's completely secular. When the appointment was made to the Supreme Court instead, Taft was livid, and he denounced Brandeis, claiming that he was no Jew, until he lost the Attorney General job. And since then, he's tried to show himself to be the top Jew in the country, that he adopted Zionism, which Brandeis did, to bolster his Jewish credentials. And Taft said that now, only now, after all this time, Brandeis favors the New Jerusalem and has metaphorically been recircumcised. He has gone all over the country making speeches, arousing the Jewish spirit, even wearing a hat in the synagogue while making a speech in order to attract those bearded rabbis. If necessary, I am sure he would have grown a beard to convince them he was a Jew of Jews. All this has made it politically difficult for not only the Jews, but for anybody looking for office where there are Jews in the constituency, to hesitate about opposing Brandeis. All in all, a very interesting accusation, but a result of their latent competition for the same job. 5 years later, Taft will be appointed the Chief Justice and sit together with Brandeis, and now in his dream job, Taft slimmed down to 260 pounds. He served until he retired in 1930 because of illness, just a month before he died, became the first president buried in Arlington National Cemetery. While Chief Justice, Taft was asked to eulogize Simon Wolfe, no longer ubiquitous. He died in 1923. And he did, calling him a leader in Israel, a man of intellectual force, of conviction, and courage of expression. In his death, the country loses a patriot and the Jewish people a strong man. In summary, Roosevelt and Taft never fully reconciled. Roosevelt died fairly suddenly on January 6, 1919. He was 60 years old. His son Archie cabled his brothers, still with the army in Europe, five words: "The old lion is dead." His visage on Mount Rushmore, and he's the only 20th century president on Mount Rushmore, and his strong personality made Roosevelt one of America's most memorable presidents for his deeds and for his writings. And his writings are really tremendous, eloquent, evocative. I'll just end almost with one of my favorite Roosevelt statements. He wrote, "To judge a man merely by success is an abhorrent wrong. It is not the critic who counts, not the man who points out how the strong man stumbles or where the doer of deeds could have done them better. The credit belongs to the man who is actually in the arena, whose face is marred by dust and sweat and blood, who strives valiantly, who errs and comes short again and again, because there's no effort without error and shortcoming, but who does actually strive to do the deeds, who knows the great enthusiasms, the great devotions, who spends himself in a worthy cause, who at the best knows in the end the triumph of high achievement, and who at the worst, if he fails, at least fails while daring greatly, so that his place shall never be with those cold and timid souls who know neither victory nor defeat." Very eloquent. In 1932, Rav Eliezer Silver bought land in Cincinnati on which to build a mikveh. The Reform Jews protested, hired a lawyer who had been a Jew, had been Cincinnati's mayor, and the Municipal Zoning Board ruled the land could not be used for a mikveh. Rav Silver retained Robert Taft, the son, then just a prominent attorney, soon to be U.S. Senator, to represent him in the appeal. Taft drafted a letter with Rav Silver's help, and Taft's personality and reputation was such that the Reform withdrew their objections and the mikveh was built. In the end, Taft, the president, did not have the success he had in other positions and could never really escape from Theodore Roosevelt, but both of them were good souls and friends of the Jews, and both were extraordinarily fair people whose love of justice reflected their love of the Jewish people as well. I thank you all very much. Next week, we'll look at the presidency of Woodrow Wilson, especially America's role, such as it was in the Balfour Declaration, and the Jews in World War I as well. Again, thank you. Erev Tov.